You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So I have Brian Johnson on the phone. Brian, how are you doing?
Hi, James. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, to talk to you again. Last time we spoke, I just want to say to the audience, last time we spoke, it was amazing. It was 2.5 years ago. You were you had started an amazing company, Braintree, which was processing credit card payments for, I guess, thousands of companies. And then I actually included the interview with you as a chapter in Choose Yourself, because you were very much a man who chose himself in starting that company and in other things you were doing. And then since we've spoken, this is the second time we've spoken, you sold that company for $800 million to eBay, right? It was eBay who bought it. And now right. You've started your own venture capital fund, and it's different from other venture capital funds. You're specifically investing in companies, my interpretation, that you think or you hope are save the world sort of companies, as opposed to just how can I make money the fastest sort of companies.
Yeah, a lot's happened the past 2.5 years for sure.
And so tell me, let's start with the beginning. Like, it was really only a short while after we spoke that I feel like Braintree got sold for $800 million. Like, how did that feel? Like, what happened? How did you get the call?
I mean, it's remarkable in that it's complicated. And I spoke to a couple of other friends before this happened. But, you know, at Braintree, we poured our heart and soul into that company. Like, we really, really cared. I mean, I had three goals for the company. One is that the employees would say is the best company they'd ever worked for. The engineers would say is the best payments platform in the industry. And three, that customers would write us love letters. And we didn't make any other goals on user growth, on revenue, profits, nothing. The idea was we get these three things right and everything takes care of itself. And we achieved those goals. Like, we literally had customers writing us love letters on a daily basis. And so it was I mean, it was obviously a great outcome, but at the same time, we really did put our heart and soul into the company. So it was one of the best experiences of my entire life, and I'm extremely proud of the team and what we were able to achieve.
Well, let me ask you this, because you said two things that in many companies are actually sort of the opposites. Like, usually there's management, and the management has to manage the engineers who are building the product, and they also have to manage, you know, dealing with the customers. And often those two things clash. The engineers will say, we can't get that done in time, or we're not spending enough time with our families because we're working day and night to get to, because you're pushing us or you'll fire us. So how did you manage to kind of keep that balance of managing engineers while still pleasing the customers?
Well, it was just part of the culture. It actually wasn't a battle internally. We all just knew that was the primary objective, was to have them write us love letters. So everyone did remarkable things on their own accord. I didn't say anything. It wasn't like we mapped out. It's just people just did stuff. And like, for example, we'd have people, engineers that would code to our API, you know, coding their software so it speaks to our software. And when we noticed there was a problem, we would reach out to them and say, hey, we see you're coding to the API. Can we help you out anyway? And they'd be like, what? Like, who does that? Who reaches out and proactively tries to take care of problems? The same thing on the customer support side. They would just proactively call customers. And we also did things like we would fire customers if they were rude to us or mean or just jerks. And they, you know, if I would see like a customer service person with their head down feeling bad because someone just berated them, we'd talk about it. And if they were just continually a jerk, we'd fire them as a customer. It just wasn't worth their money to create that kind of mood in the environment of the company. So, I mean, we were really thoughtful about how we dealt with this. And people just naturally did it. We just hired really great people, and they behaved in ways that made people happy.
How do you, you know, and I want to really eventually get to the meat of this, which is kind of where you're seeing future trends and what you're investing in and how the world's changing. But I'm really fascinated by issues of leadership and excellence. And what you accomplished with Braintree was very hard. And I always describe the story of how you built it, and that was a very impressive story. But when you were in the thick of it and already a mature company, it's interesting to me how you – like, how do you hire, like, quality people like that?
So we did a couple things.
Because that's hard. Like, people say that the critical success of a company is based on who you hire.
100%. So we did a couple things to maintain a pristine environment internally, because I never wanted, like, a slow degrading of talent or of morale. And so, for example, I learned a couple important lessons. Like, one is everyone always has a pebble in their shoe. Like, you do, I do. We're always worried about something or upset or annoyed. And so every Friday or every other Friday, different frequencies, we'd have these town hall meetings. And it's almost like group therapy where anyone could bring up anything. And I would let uncomfortable silence just sit. I would encourage criticism of me if that was available, then anyone could talk about anything. And we talk about what the company problems were, what were on people's minds. And I always knew what was going on because I had my fingers on the pulse. I knew like the what was going on. But we did things like that that kept the morale very high. And then we also had just expectations internally of people. We didn't have a safety net. Like, if someone wasn't performing in a job, we didn't have – they couldn't be like shuffled over to a different department where they just now sit in silence under someone else's command. It was like everyone had to work on their own. And if they weren't holding their own weight and their peers didn't think they were remarkable, they were out. And everyone knew that expectation existed. We just didn't have any tolerance for someone who didn't contribute fully on the team.
I love that quote, everyone has a pebble in their own shoe. And can I ask you, does that apply to other areas of life? Like, for instance, when you go home to your wife and kids, do you also think that every day they have a pebble in their shoe or a different pebble?
Always. I mean, my kids, everyone. So like the thing is, and sometimes you don't even have to solve it, right? It's just simply by acknowledging there's a pebble in the shoe, sometimes it just goes away. But yes, I mean, like, you do this morning and I do today, right? We have stuff that's bothering us.
Yeah, totally. Like, it's sort of like you kind of wake up every morning fresh and the sun is out, and then suddenly, like, your entire history of decades sort of swoops in and you say, ugh, I got to get up today. Like, so it's hard every day. But, like, today, for instance, or yesterday, you get home from your work at your fund. What pebble do you think was in your wife's shoe?
Well, certainly a lot. But I mean, it really depends on the person and the circumstances, right? In terms of like how big it is, how it needs to be addressed. But I remember like in our town hall meetings that I could feel the tension build all week. And it was typically like one or two or three things. And once we addressed it as a group, there was the energy just changed in the room. People felt lighter and happier and like ready to carry on.
Like what's an example?
So like one time we hired, I forget what position it was for, but we hired someone outside the company instead of promoting someone from within. And it's like, okay, well, why did we hire someone from outside and not promote within? And the answer was like the qualifications weren't right. That's a hard thing to say. But it was true. And so to stay consistent with our culture, we had to be honest and transparent. And so we talked about it.
Was there one person specifically who felt that you were wrong, that in fact internally they had the qualifications?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a clear path because we didn't have specific groups. But there was some disagreement, certainly, and especially people who thought that they might be appropriate for the position. And, you know, they may have been right. It was just a judgment call on the general vagueness of the roles we had in the company, because things change so fast in a startup. You think you know what you're doing, but then it changes the next day. So but things like that are hard to quantify and hard to nail down. People have differences of opinions. The personal accomplishments are at stake. It's hard for everyone involved. And so we tried to address all those things head on instead of letting them linger and then decay the environment.
That's great. So I think, you know, that reminds me of I'm reading Creativity Inc. right now by Ed Catmull, who was the CEO of Pixar. And he had a very similar strategy. Like it seems like as CEO of Pixar, he was constantly trying to figure out essentially what was the pebble in everybody's shoe and then solving it. Like sometimes the production had problems, sometimes the creatives had problems, sometimes the artists had problems, sometimes Disney had a problem. He was always trying to sniff out because he didn't always know what the pebble in the shoe was, and he had to figure it out first. It was like a puzzle. And the great thing about that book, and it reminds me of what you're describing here, he doesn't talk at all about the business issues of Pixar. He talks about his issues as a leader trying to manage a group of creatives to create an enormously powerful product, essentially so the customers who were all of us watching his movies would write love letters.
Yep, I love it. I mean, I think as a counterpoint though, James, on that, I remember like in the first couple of years building Braintree, I wanted like perfect happiness inside the company. I want everyone to show up for me. He's like, hey, like I'm so happy to be here and I can't wait to work and I'm going to work with this group. We're going to solve this problem. I got frustrated because there was always problems, like, you know, whatever, interpersonal conflicts or whatever, not bad ones, but just like typical human stuff. And over the years, I learned that there was like this natural level of chaos that was actually healthy for the company in our own self and in the company environment. And I kind of sat back a little bit and just let that level of chaos find its right balance. Like you can't let it get too far because then it gets it's corrosive, but you also can't try to be too over the top on it and try to smother it. And that was always a delicate balance of trying to figure out where that appropriate level of chaos was where we could still achieve our goals. But not let it go too far one way or the other.
Yeah, and I don't know how you do that. Like I've managed small companies, not as big as Braintree, and usually when someone starts engaging in, let's say, corrosive behavior, like let's as an example, saying negative things about the customers or gossiping about their bosses or whatever, I would usually just ask them to leave the company. But you're right, if you kind of fire everywhere you see a problem, you're going to be seen as a kind of totalitarian, like too much is too much of a bad thing. So how do you balance that?
I trusted the people on the team. So for example, if someone came to me with a problem and said, you know, the way we do this particular process or structure is really broken and we're not solving it, I'd say, all right, go figure it out, solve it. Like you don't need my permission or approval, go solve it. And if it requires, you know, changing the team process structure or getting new software in place, that's fine. But figure out a way to do it. And so I really relied upon them to solve the problems. It was not me trying to dictate from above how everything should be done, but it was creating the right systems. And we did have, right, that did create some element of chaos because we had people solving things all over the place. But in the end, I mean, I think the proof was that our customers loved what we did for them and the product spoke for itself. And so I think we did achieve some good balance in those all those competing priorities.
So tell me what was going on in your head. Like, I guess you were on the board of Braintree after you kind of moved on to other things. Like, what was going on in your head when eBay kind of called you guys up and said, okay, we're going to offer you $800 million?
So, I mean, it all happened so fast, right? And it's it's a hard thing to do emotionally. You're both excited, and it's also a big change because what's you've been devoting your heart and soul to for the past, whatever, you know, 7 years is about to change. You know, I've been thinking about what I wanted to do with life. I mean, since I think you and I spoke about this before, like at age 21, I just returned home from Ecuador, where I lived among extreme poverty for 2 years. And I came home with this burning desire to devote my life to trying to improve the lives of people. And I didn't know what that meant at 21. I tried to look at the things I could find in college, like UN, Model UN, or working in, on ships in Africa or whatever. But nothing really spoke to me as the right move. And so I decided I'd become an entrepreneur, retire by 30, and then spend the rest of my life with abundance of time and money trying to do some good. And so I've been thinking about that for the past decade. I mean, I for 13 years, I thought about how to do that. And I've been studying science and technology. And like the key insight that was most relevant to me was that we're at this incredibly unique and exciting time in life, in particular in the arc of humanity, because we have these incredibly powerful tools of creation, like computer software, biology, genomics, artificial intelligence, virtual reality. We can literally author or program any kind of world we can imagine for the first time in history. So like Leonardo da Vinci had his sketchbooks where he identified a flying machine and scuba, but he couldn't create it because he didn't have tools to create them. We do now. And so the distance between imagination and creation has never been more narrow. And so it was this exciting opportunity to like jump to this new phase of life, something I wanted to do since I was 21, and actually work on something that I thought would be truly have the opportunity to benefit, you know, billions of people for generations to come.
And so you started a fund, you put some of your money in, I assume you raised some money, and your goal is to kind of find these technologies that very few people understand. Like you mentioned quite a bit, synthetic biology, for instance, which is,
right,
you know, rarely talked about. There are no public synthetic biology companies. I haven't seen a big synthetic biology exit, for instance. So you mentioned a bunch of trends like virtual reality, AI, you know, what are some other trends that you just mentioned that maybe I missed?
Yeah. So, I mean, the premise is that, I mean, so first, the objective is to benefit the lives of billions of people for generations to come. And the question is, how do you do that? And so the investment thesis is that the biggest changes in society happen at the operating system level. So that's why I call it the OS fund. So just like a computer has an operating system at its core, then applications that run on top, everything in life has an operating system. And so if you look, for example, through history, humans create tools, and those tools then define humanity. So you think about the printing press as a tool of creation, about people could write words, print words, and distribute that information to persuade people's opinions and deliver knowledge.
So can I ask a question, Brian, just to understand the phrase operating system? In that context with the printing press, is the kind of act of publishing sort of the operating system of spreading a message?
That's right. So, okay. I mean, for example, you take communication, right? First, we had words, right? Then we graduate to the printing press, right? It's like these big changes in terms of how humans interact, how they communicate, how they attain knowledge, how they retain knowledge, like these massive changes in society.
As an example of an upgrade or downgrade, however you view it, would you say that the change of, you know, most people now get their news off of social media. So would you say the operating system of news has been going towards print to social media? Is that a valuable way to use the phrase operating system?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's probably, I mean, it's obviously vague and it's open to interpretation, but I'd say that's a much smaller shift than the types of changes we're talking about. So for example, like I'll give you one that I think is big. And I call these tools of creation. So biology. So we figured out a couple decades ago that we could program zeros and ones in computer software to achieve predictable outcomes. Like we can program software to complete a credit card transaction or to run an autopilot system in an airplane, all kinds of things. So we are just figuring out now how to program biology. So your biology, I'm biology, the world runs on biology. We now have these tools that allow us to program biology, which means we can program literally everything in our world. It's a remarkable change in our ability to, right, to build any kind of world we can imagine. And that's the kind of function, a step function we're investing in. The things would just change the outcome of the human race.
So step function is, and just to kind of define the phrase, rather than a slow, gradual climb, It's like we're at one level and then boom, we're at the next level.
Yes.
And so what's an example? Okay, so you were going to give an example of like how can I visibly see this step function in action, or what will it take for me to visibly see it? Because this is one of those things that are small but compounding. When's the tipping point that I'll be able to actually visibly see?
Exactly. So there's this company we just invested in called Ginkgo Bioworks. They're in Boston. And they take an organism and they program that organism to perform a specific function. So it could be they want this organism to produce a particular fragrance or a flavor like stevia, or it could be a probiotic. But you're literally programming these organisms to manufacture certain outputs. And so that's like on the base level of the complexity scale, like on a level one. I don't want to call it easy because it's very, very, very hard. But as we get better at programming biology, these organisms can produce other things as well. And so the idea is as companies like Ginkgo get better at systematically programming organisms to perform certain functions, we can take on things like carbon capture for environmental work and other things. And so when we get our heads around the ability to predictably program biology, there's nothing we probably couldn't try to achieve.
So for instance, when you say like carbon capture, so they can program a brand new life form or take a life form that exists and reprogram their functionality to effectively capture carbon that goes into the atmosphere.
Right.
Or effectively become a probiotic or give off a certain fragrance.
That's right.
Okay. So like right now, does the company have the technology or are they working on it?
No, they have it now. They have customers who are paying them for these organisms and this production. So
what's a sample customer? What do they get?
Well, like you could have like a beverage company that wants a input to their beverage, and that they currently buy it one way and these guys are providing them another way to do it through an organism. And so it's cheaper input, it's more healthy. For example, another example is Hampton Creek, which is they do the Just Mayo products. We're also an investor there. So they take, instead of using the chicken egg for the protein source, they take the chickpea as a plant-based protein and use that to use inputs for food, and also working on an egg substitute. And so it's repurposing what biology can actually produce for purposes that fit into our natural world.
That's interesting. So, and what's the end outcome? Like what do you see that we could potentially see, let's say within 20 years?
It's the same question that we would have asked ourselves 20 years ago when we said, wow, we can program zeros and ones in this computer code and do stuff, right? So, and what is computer code in our life now? Where are computers? How important are they to our society? I think the same question we pose for biology.
Well, I guess thinking selfishly, I would want to program my own biology to be smarter, faster, and younger.
Right. Right. So that's another one of our investments is in a company called Human Longevity, started by Craig Venter, who sequenced the first human genome, I believe in 2000. And what they're trying to do is build the world's largest database of whole human genomes and then adding other relevant health information like the microbiome and phenotype data, and then using advanced machine learning to understand more how our bodies work, about utilized for personalized health, drug discovery. They just did a deal with an insurance company for South Africa and London, where they're providing gene sequencing for their employees to help them identify gene risks and other things to help them maintain better health. So like more of a personalized medicine approach.
So are they limited by weaknesses in statistics? Like let's say statistics aren't sophisticated enough to do that.
They will certainly need a large number of samples because running the data is only as relevant as your sample size. And so it's a quest to build a very large database, and the target is 1 million whole human genomes by 2020. And once you have a data set that size, you can do really significant things. But even now, in the relatively small size, I believe that the largest whole human genome sequencing center in the world now, and even now, we're finding interesting things that we didn't know before.
Well, in some sense, it's the same statistics as speech recognition. So how do you recognize what word, how does Siri on the iPhone recognize what word I'm saying? It's not anticipating any word. It has to take this sound and match it against a million patterns and figure out what closely matches, rather than it never knows what exactly matches. It has to figure out what closely matches. So, and that's like millions of patterns. And it took, let's say it took 20 years to get, or 25 years to get to the level it is right now.
Here's a comparison I'd give you for genomics. A couple hundred years ago, I think the life expectancy was mid-40s, I think. And then we figured out there was this thing called bacteria that developed into germ theory that caused infection and death. And then we figured out that the best way to handle that was sterilization and antibiotics and vaccinations. As we've done this over the past couple hundred years, we've increased life expectancy, I think, the most in the history of the human race, now to the mid-70s. The question now is, how do we extend healthy human life now to 100, 120? Like, where can we go from here? And the theory is that germ theory has run its course. We now even have it backfiring with like super bugs that are killing us. And so the hypothesis I have about human longevity is they could be the equivalent of germ theory. They could be the breakthrough of like genomics-based personalized health, could be the breakthrough that allows us to live a healthy life past 100.
And when would like how would it work? So do you play around with babies or do you play around with people who are older? Like, can you and I live to 100, 120?
I mean, so the general, how it's applied, right, is TBD. But the general premise is if you can acquire this data, the software that runs humans, the genome, and if you can learn things about it, about why we age, why we develop disease, where our susceptibilities are, if you simply have that data, it's enormously valuable to a whole ecosystem of providers who want to develop solutions to address it. So whether it's stem cells or whatever else, or gene editing, those solutions will be developed in time. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but what I don't understand is our genes sort of define who we are, like what height we'll grow to, what our hair color will be, what our eye color will be. And I know that's just the basics, but if I have like a heart disease, for instance, how will mucking with my genes change the attributes of my heart disease?
Well, so it's here's an example. It's not necessarily changing your genes for your heart disease, right? Right now, it would be that if you have heart disease, maybe there's a drug company that's made a specific drug to address heart disease, and that this drug only works in populations that have a specific genetic structure. So they may say, James, like, okay, you're the lucky guy because this drug is super effective and 80% of people who take it, but you have to have this particular genetic structure, and you do. So it allows for personalized delivery of drugs and other care based upon your own personalized information.
I get it. So the first application, which is incredibly powerful, and people don't realize how powerful this is, the first application in what you're talking about is diagnostics, essentially. Because it's very hard to find a drug that works for you given a disease. But if you could genetically match using statistics, oh, given this genome, whatever, and this illness, we know this drug works 90% of the time, that's very successful. And there's a whole industry around depression, for instance, that works that way.
That's right. Yep. And the same is true in the principle. If you have this data and you can make it available to the ecosystem of people trying to come up with solutions, and that includes drugs or could be stem cell therapy, it could be any number of things, right, that they can then base their solution design on this information. And that's why it's such a huge breakthrough. That's why it could be the next big germ theory for us and to help us extend for a couple decades in our life expectancy, because with this information, we finally have a data set that allows us to intelligently construct solutions. Right now, we're just kind of stabbing in the dark.
Right. So again, like, it's almost like a prevention is the cure sort of thing. Rather than developing the cure, you're helping more with kind of this area between prevention and the cure. So the cure is already made, but we just don't know what people match what cures in many cases. And the deeper understanding of the genetics involved will help us match the right person with the right cure.
That's true. Yeah. And it's also on the preventative side. If I find something in my genome that I have a proclivity for X, Y, or Z, I can modify my behavior today to account for that increased risk. So again, it's just information that allows me to make decisions on both preventative and actual care.
What about just remapping my genes? So for instance, let's say I have a proclivity for Alzheimer's. But there's no known cure or for Alzheimer's other than just, changing my gene, changing the DNA that suggests I could potentially get it. What can you do there?
So, I mean, gene editing is an extremely exciting and vibrant field, and it's not ready for prime time yet, especially for humans. But I know that there's an enormous number of people working on this right now. I should say enormous. There's a good number of people working on this right now, and it's very promising. And I think people are cautiously optimistic on the potential, but it certainly needs to go through a vetting process for the science to mature a bit. But yeah, certainly an extremely viable solution set that we could have in the coming years/decades.
You know, it's an interesting thing, and this is a tangent on this, but it sort of seems like there's two types of entrepreneurs. There's the one who says, okay, I want to solve a billion person problem, and at the very fringes of science is gene editing. So I'm going to study everything I know about that. I'm going to maybe apprentice myself to a company that's working on it, and then I'm going to find my own unique path and start a company and create the next and latest and greatest gene editing company. Another chain of thought among entrepreneurs says, well, I have a more efficient way to buy and combine the back end efficiencies of laundromats. And so I'm going to buy all the laundromats I can and combine the back end efficiencies and then take it public or sell it to a private equity firm and make that way. And what do you think, one side obviously is thinking more about the money, although both sides will end up making a lot of money. It's hard to say which will make more. But what do you think turns, it seems like startup entrepreneurs are not necessarily thinking the gene editing. They're thinking more, well, okay, here's a known way I can make money, which is buying a bunch of companies, getting rid of the inefficiencies, and then flipping it for a greater amount of money. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that. What are the two different types of entrepreneurs you see there? And how does one become one versus the other?
Yeah, so I guess I may have a different perspective on this because – as I've worked on this, like working on these kinds of problems is relevant to me based upon my personal experiences in life and what I care about. And so to me, I feel I like what I'm doing. I like what I'm pursuing.
And you probably see that in the entrepreneurs you work with, as opposed to if you were dealing with the CEO of a multi-laundromat company who might not care about laundromats, but is interested in kind of, organization efficiency and ultimately, the profits at the end of the day.
Yep. So yes, but that's true. But I guess I would say that there's been like this, there's this general undertone of like, oh, well, you're not working on something world changing. So therefore like that's not important. Or like, because you're working on laundromats, that's not like a really important thing to the world. I disagree. I think that everyone's contribution matters. And I think that it's the ecosystem of collective contribution through building businesses from laundromats to stem cells to gene editing that makes the contribution work. And I think that this like underlying snobbery on like I'm working on something important and you're not is inappropriate. I think that everyone's contribution is meaningful and it builds into the entire ecosystem. Like planet Earth is this amazing platform where we get to exist and build, and we get to build whatever we want, and we exist in societies that have certain rules. But I think it's an unhealthy and unhelpful thought process to introduce snobbery about what one person is working on and the value associated with that versus someone else.
I totally agree, and you're the first person where I've heard you've said two great phrases so far. Everyone has a pebble in their shoe, and planet Earth is a platform. Because I don't think anyone has ever thought of planet Earth that way before, in the sense that it used to be, let's say 20,000 years ago, the village was the platform. Then the city was the platform or the city state. Then the kingdom. Then the empire. Now we have all these countries as platforms. Like the United States is a platform, is a certain type of platform for a certain brand of capitalism. But I wonder if because of the of how fast innovation is going, it's almost going faster than political barriers, and eventually those political barriers will all fall, so that planet Earth really does become the platform for innovation and capitalism and industry.
It's like, so I have spent quite a lot of time on government as an idea, and I think that if you look at it in the most raw form, I mean, government is a form of cooperation. It's a technology of cooperation. It's basically how we live within the geographical area of the United States and how we cooperate together in terms of getting along, of rules, of allocating resources, of reconciling our differences. It's just a structure of cooperation. And we have these structures around the world with the treaties, with other countries have their own governments. And our systems of cooperation or governance are extremely important to our ability to thrive in humanity. And I think you're right that the current system we have today is challenged in so many ways, and it's behind the time, and we will have to reconsider from fundamental ways how we work together, both within our geographical boundaries, but also globally. And in the end, they're just technologies. It's a rule set on how people cooperate and get along and achieve certain things, and what people can and cannot pursue and how they can and cannot live. I do think it's due for an enormous rewrite, a relevant rewrite, given the progress of technological advancement.
I wonder if that will happen naturally. Like, so as Craig Venter starts collaborating with some Chinese company to, I don't know, manufacture his new organisms, and again, these are saving millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of lives or extending lives, I wonder if just automatically it'll become very natural for trade barriers to go down and then other barriers to go down and so on, until it's almost like we're living in one big political environment divided into maybe states, but not as the barriers won't be as hard grafted as they are from country to country.
Yeah, I think there's always going to be the yin and yang of cooperation conflict. I don't think we're ever going to cross the hill and say, wow, like we're now in this blissful state. I think we're always going to have this inherent level of challenge and threat and chaos in the world, and we're going to have to work our way through every moment. But I do think that we need to be extremely thoughtful. I mean, if you contemplate like how past changes have gone by, we've done well when we've had a theoretical revolution prior to a practical revolution. So, for example, like when the United States, when the founding fathers sat down to write the Constitution and said, how do we actually contemplate our society? They could look back and find people like John Locke, who had been thinking about this for a long time and written about this. And they were able to build upon his theoretical framework on what governance structures should look like. And I think it would be enormously helpful if we had the same thing now, that we were giving serious thought to our structures in advance, so that if we ever had a chance to reconsider our governmental frameworks, we'd done hard thinking about these things ahead of time. We just didn't make it up in the moment.
You know, I wonder if that doesn't happen now, because essentially as soon as one becomes a thinker like John Locke, they instantly go on, I don't know, the Bill Maher show, and it all becomes political punditry and the message gets kind of lost in the noise.
I mean, sometimes, but those who I think can really discern out the gems of the intellectual scaffolding, I think we won't pay attention to that type of retail translation. I think they'll understand the core essence of it. But I mean, these exogenous shocks happen. Like, for example, you think about what happened with the financial crisis, right? This a big thing happened. We had a lot of problems. And then Congress said, what do we do about it? And they just made, you know, some stuff had been thought of before, but they made a lot of stuff up on the spot. And so like these windows of opportunity open. And the question is, how good are we at taking advantage of these opportunities? Have we thought through it thoroughly? Have we been considerate? Have we meditated on this? Have we thought about it for a while?
So what other companies are you, what other kind of life-changing technologies are you looking at? Or what's the future hold in store that you haven't mentioned yet?
Another company I like a lot is Matternet, which is working on autonomous vehicles or drones. And so it's both a solution for the developing world and developed world. But I think that they could do for transportation what the smartphone did for communications. If you think about how it transformed Asia and Africa. And so, for example, like they initially started a pilot in Bhutan, taking medical supplies to remote villages because the roads are just unpassable. In fact, if you're going to build a road infrastructure in Africa that matched the United States, it would take $4 trillion in 23 years. They're also doing a pilot in Switzerland this summer, delivering mail So it works both in congested areas and places where roads are impassable. But I think that autonomous vehicles are a promising technology to leapfrog existing challenges in our transportation.
Can I ask you this? Because this is one, my one fear. I was at a kind of a conference recently, and on the stage, and one of the aspects of the conference was that there were these drones flying around, kind of recording things. And I wondered, like, how easy is it going to be at some point for people to just put a bomb in a drone and just blow shit up?
Yeah, it's the same question that happened when we figured out fire, right? And they burned a village down.
Well, that's a really good point, because fire was the first time in, like, Earth history that a single, let's call it organism, in this case a human, was able to burn down, you know, millions of you know, other organisms.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that in all of these technologies, in genomics, in biology, in drones, I and these founders are fully aware of the risks that are present. And the reason, one of the reasons why I invest in these founders is that I consider them to be future literate, that they understand the general contours of the future. They understand the risks that are present, and they're thoughtful about them. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't develop the technology. It just means that we need to be thoughtful and careful and
right, but you
about
guys,
how we do it.
You guys are like the good guys, though. Imagine there's like the anti-version of yourself who's one of the bad guys, and he really does want to create drones with bombs. Like, what is there in place? There's nothing really in place to stop that kind of behavior. So it's sort of like we have to assume that society advances faster than the bad guys can catch up with it. And I'm being very simplistic by calling them bad guys, but that's sort of the general idea.
I agree. And I think that friction will always exist.
But now we're at a level, though, where the capacity for like we thought with nuclear weapons, the capacity for danger was too big to stop. But these smaller dangers on a mass level, I view as more dangerous than you know, nuclear weapons.
I agree. And I think that's why one of the most important questions facing humanity is how our systems of cooperation will evolve appropriately over time to keep these threats in check, right? So how do we actually identify the risks, appropriately take measures for them, but also allow the technology to move forward and us to live lives that we desire? It's an extremely complicated question, but I do think systems of cooperation and government is central to our ability to thrive. And we have to, because they go hand in hand. And it's just it's a very complicated one.
They do. And you look at like, you know, I won't name specific companies, but there are the big sacrifice that society has to make in what you're saying, it seems to me, is privacy. Because if you're starting a company, you have to be able to open yourself up to some extent to be looked at, or people, or at least viewed in some way that you might not be aware of. Is this company doing something really bad or not?
Yeah, I totally agree with you on the risks. I mean, that's why it's both an incredibly exciting time to be on planet Earth, but also unnerving, because we have to contemplate all these new realities that we're dealing with, realities and threats and possibilities.
So now here's another question, a future question. When I was a kid, I loved the TV show The $6 Million Man. So when are you going to show me a company that can recreate The $6 Million Man for less than $6 million?
So I'm not familiar with the show. What do they do?
You're not familiar with the show. You must be much younger than me. So basically, a pilot has a crash and he loses both his legs, one of his arms, and one of his eyes. And they give him prosthetics that look totally human. You can't tell he's wearing any prosthetics. And he can run 60 miles an hour. He has supervision, and he can lift anything.
So I just met up with a researcher last week who's working on the problem of building a prosthetic that restores natural touch and stimulation through that. So if you lose an arm, that he could regrow the nerves and nerve endings into the fingertips to restore the natural touch. So funny you mentioned that, but yeah, I think that it's in process, and I mean, who knows when it's going to happen, but I think people are certainly thinking about that.
And that's just one step away of, imagine I have the nerves going from my fingertips to my brain, but my arm now is made out of titanium. and my my brain has the power to lift a car or whatever.
Yeah, it's so funny because you know, when I was growing up, we watched Saved by the Bell, and now my kids watch. I think it's called Lab Rats, and it's a show about this inventor who has three bionic kids that live in the basement, and like one has super speed, one's smart, and I think one is strong, or I think something like that. And so my son, he's 10. He's always asking me, like, Dad, like, when can I get bionics? Like, tell me when. And like, when your company's developed this stuff, like, can I be first in line to have it? It's like, it's funny because it's top of mind for him. Like, he views it as reality and serious potential. And like, he's interested, and this is a real life application. So, I mean, I think that's changing in terms of how people understand it and the potential it has.
Well, it's interesting because you look at the mythology of the past century. Where does it start? Like, we were in the middle of the Great Depression and we needed hero, like that's where Superman was born, like 1937 in the middle of the Great Depression. Or in the blossoming of the nuclear age, you have all these heroes created by accidents and radiation, like Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk. Like, all these guys were involved in radiation accidents. So now it seems like kind of the science fiction of the past is the science of the future, and this stuff you're telling me companies that exist now where we can potentially see the path to superhero-dom.
I think back to these tools of creation. Once we figure out like these base level tools of genomics and biology and autonomous drones, these other things, solutions build on top of them, and that's why we are making this bet, because we believe that if you invest in, for example, a printing press, right, or the equivalent to genomics or biology, that the type of solutions it will lead to on top are just unimaginable today, but are the platforms we need to invest in if we truly want to build a world where we can all thrive in.
So it seems like your fund has a competitor, which is Google. So Google, their reorganization of Alphabet kind of enhances, let's say, the role of Google X, which is working on all of the same types of things.
And you know, I wouldn't call them a competitor. I'd call them a collaborator. I mean, I found that the world of investing in these types of things is it doesn't stand up to the stories I hear, for example, when people fighting over like trying to invest in other software, internet apps. It's much more collaborative. And so I found it to be a very generous and open community. In fact, last week we introduced what we call the OS Fund Playbook. And so when I first started investing in science, I don't have a scientific background. So the question I had is like, how do I, as a non-scientist, invest in hard science? And we also pose a question of how do we make a larger contribution to the world, because the fund is $100 million, but we wanted to make the contribution to be much bigger. And so we developed an internal decision-making model on how to actually fund science using decision analysis. And so we open sourced our playbook, and we basically said like, here's how we're making decisions. Here's how we're investing in companies. Here's the process we take. And hopefully it's helpful to all of you who are interested in investing in hard science, just haven't in the past, or are doing it, want to get better. And so it was a gesture of trying to, you know, contribute within the community, also collaborate with people on trying to collectively make better decisions on what kind of companies to fund. And so I think that the community has strong characteristics that will be beneficial for all of us as we try to develop these technologies.
And let me ask you, so I like the idea of, in general, the notion of a playbook, of an open source playbook. Do you feel this is similar to how you kind of managed Braintree?
I mean, in some ways. I mean, for example, like the biggest problem we faced at Braintree early on was that companies would store a company's credit card data. So I would do recurring billing where I billed 40,000 people a month every month. And if I wanted to leave one provider and go to the next, they'd hold you hostage, just like the telcos did that with phone numbers before. And so we did an open data standard for the industry and said, why don't we all just cooperate and like share data and let's compete on product and quality, not on incumbency. And we were largely successful in that endeavor. And I guess I've always been interested in like community collaboration, trying to solve problems together. I've never been like a cutthroat competitor trying to tear someone down and win because I can do that.
Well, it's funny. It's related to Peter Thiel's 0 to 1. Where he basically says the essence of capitalism is not competition, but avoiding competition, which is why PayPal merged with X.com rather than compete with them.
Right. Right. So, maybe, yeah, to create a monopoly, right, in whatever industry you're in.
And so you're relatively new at the fund game, so I'm assuming you haven't had any major exits yet, but are you seeing good things happen?
We are. We're very pleased with the investments we've made and the progress these companies are making.
And these companies like have good management, like they're not like in danger of like you don't have to hold their hands through every single issue.
No, I mean as a founder, now investor, my preference is I always tell them I will stay entirely out of your hair. If you ever want anything, call me, but otherwise I'm out. Because you know, as a founder running a company, you know, like it's just incredibly hard. And the last thing you need is someone calling you saying, "Could you give me an update?" or "Could you talk to me?" So I just try to stay out of the way and try to be helpful when they ask.
Well, I find as an angel investor now, the hardest thing is when, you know, the companies that are doing well, I never hear from them. Like I have to beg them to talk to me. But the companies that call me every day are the ones that are in trouble. And I have kind of learned pretty quickly that maybe only 1 out of 10 of those will succeed, no matter how much effort I personally do to help them succeed at that point.
Yeah, I assume that I'm going to offer no help to these people when I make the investment. Like the return I'm expecting or the change in the world, I'm assuming that I am a net zero value add.
So other than this fund, how has your life changed? Like you obviously made an enormous amount of money when you sold Braintree. How else has your life changed?
So I've noticed like a big change in how I operate on a daily basis. Before, when I was running Braintree, I may have had like 50 decisions in a given day, like someone to hire, someone to fire, a customer problem to deal with, like a team reconciliation issue, like, you know, all these things you deal with. And now I'm working on like much more longer term, big opportunities and challenges. And so now my days consist of maybe solving like 4 or 5 things a day. And so I've had to create longer periods of flow states that I can work on these problems, because jumping in and giving 15 minutes to a problem is just insufficient. It requires a lot more thought. And so it's been a nice change in terms of how I operate on a daily basis, which has been really satisfying. But you know, I guess most of life has just continued on as it was before. Like you really haven't changed all that much.
So like you didn't like upgrade to a massive house or anything like that?
No, I still drive the same car. yeah. So I haven't bought a big house.
So really it just kind of like transferred into this fund where you now are involved in multiple companies rather than just Braintree. And how do you get into that flow state now for these different types of problems? Like what do you do to kind of trigger flow?
I mean, a couple things. One is I try to allocate time where I turn the world off and just simply work on a particular problem. So I'll turn the phone off. I'll get the computer. I'll lock the computer away and just write on paper and try to just focus entirely on that. And then when I get stuck, I have a handful of people I usually can call and say, "Let me just talk to you for 10 minutes. I just need to like verbally express this. I need you to ask me a couple questions and I can move on with this." And so I have this structure where I can help myself get unstuck pretty quickly, and that these interactions can be highly productive because I know what kind of thing I'm looking for. And then I'm open to like changing my frame of mind dramatically based upon what the person offers as insights. And so I'm trying to get better at it, but I do like this process that I have. And I do think that it's been very helpful in terms of the decisions we're making, both in the fund and other things I'm working on.
And what other stuff are you working on?
This next year, I'm going to hopefully launch a community for children. And I wrote a children's book. And
you're kidding. What's the children's book?
It's called Code 7. And it'll be published. I've printed out and I've been sharing copies with people. But formally, it'll be out next year. And I wrote it with my kids. It's an anthology. Has 7 stories. My children are the protagonists. And it takes place in their school. And it teaches important lessons of life, and it's meant to be humorous and insightful. And then the second one is going to be about AI, and so how I won't give it away, but basically how a young protagonist works with AI to rescue their parents.
That's great. You know, I like how you made your kids protagonists. Let me ask you, why didn't you make them antagonists? Like maybe they might have had more fun with that.
That's hilarious. That's a good thought. Maybe I'll raise a question with them. I mean, the objective on this thing, and I've worked with my kids, is I've looked at like what do they aspire to in life? Like what kind of models do they understand? How do they understand their place in the world? Where is humanity going? And so the objective of what I'd like to do with children is that to ultimately to reorient the identity and aspirations of humankind, and specifically for them to realize that we have these incredibly powerful tools of creation at our disposal, genomics, software, 3D printing, AI, and we can literally author anything we want. If that's the case, right, and they have this power to do so, and these technologies are there for their taking, that they too can dream and imagine doing things in their life that are major contributions to the world in some way or another. And so I want these children to grow up today to understand the possibilities, that why it's so unique in our time and place. And as they come of age in their prime to offer, to make their major contributions, these technologies and genomics and others will be reaching the maturity as well. And so I think that it's an important area of focus to focus on the beliefs, values, ambitions, and identity of our children, because they will be the ones who will have a huge impact on actually building the kind of world we have the capability of doing.
Well, and related to that, and this could be sort of a closing kind of question. What's so far in all of your investing journeys this past year, what's been the most amazing futuristic thing you've seen with your own eyes? And related to that, what do you think will be the most amazing thing you will see in the next 5 years?
So I would answer this. I would answer the same way I did before. You may not like my answer. It would be the same question once we said, wow, James, we just created a printing press. What do you think is possible? And like, who would have ever have guessed what would have come out of the printing press? Even today, right? What kind of stuff people write and how they communicate with the world. I think the same is true with genomics and biology and 3D printing. Like, who knows what platform is going to take us?
But you know, here's the thing. I can make the direct connection between the printing press and genomics. Right. So when the printing press was made, everyone realized suddenly they had bad vision. No one can read. So they had to create the whole science of lenses, which right. So people could read, which led to microscopes, which led to bacteria, which led to germ theory, which led to genomics. So who knows? Gutenberg certainly didn't predict genomics, and yet he created essentially the tools, the platform, you can say, the operating system to discover genomics.
I agree. And actually, maybe let me take a second stab. Platform would be one answer, and I'll tell you the second one is intelligence. I'd say the most important invention humans make is intelligence, and that's through both artificial intelligence and through our own cognitive enhancement. And I think that the coming decades, those two things will drive will be huge determinations in terms of how we actually deal with the species.
Well, it's interesting because you look at like the chess world, the best chess entity in the world is not a human, and I don't believe it's a computer either. I think it's the human computer combination, like the world champion working with the world champion computer program creates actually the best player. And so where do you see cognitive enhancement coming from in the things you're working on?
So it's currently something I'm exploring with this team. And the question is, could we in fact enhance human intelligence? And it's a new field and technologies are being developed, but it's very early on.
Is everything BS? Like, are nootropics BS?
Well, so, I mean, I don't consider those to be like real game-changing things. I mean, the kind of things we're looking at are inside the brain and things that have dramatic potential to improve cognition, and whether it be memory or whatever else. But it's brand new, and currently it's only in clinical things. Like, for example, people with epilepsy have force implants, and there's a Ted Berger's synthetic hippocampus. A DARPA just came out with an electrode they put in the brain with those who had brain surgery. So there are technologies that are actually inside the brain that have this huge – they have this huge potential. And the question is, which ones are viable? When is it – when will it be safe to come to market? How will it manifest itself? And I think that we'll know in the coming years, but it's certainly an area of great excitement and potential, but a lot of uncertainty about what it could actually do.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting area, particularly, you know, not just cognitive enhancement, but Alzheimer's is one of the biggest killers in the country.
Right.
So
that's right.
That just right there, playing with that will increase average longevity. So it's all connected. So I guess final question, are you happy? Your life's totally different than the last time we talked.
It is. I honestly have never felt more energized, excited, and determined ever in my entire life.
Does that make you feel younger? Like, you feel younger than you did 3 years ago?
I do. You know, like, I've taken up dancing. It's one of my favorite things in the whole world to do. I can go out and dance for like 6 or 7 hours straight.
You're kidding.
And I now have more energy than anyone out there. And I do. I just feel so good.
But, you know, that's a really interesting thing. So it's not like you eat more food to have more energy. It's like you found something. You know, typically we think of food as converted into energy in our body, and that's how we have energy to do things. But people neglect the fact that emotional state and mental state are critical to the energy we have in our body, and could, I bet you, eat less food as a result.
Yeah, I've dropped a lot of weight, Jeff, and I feel better than I ever have physically. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So I think that right there is a platform. You know, the kind of energetic state you find yourself in by having, you know, good relationships with your kids, obviously, because you're writing this book with them. You're staying healthy with dancing. You're creative with all the, you know, you're dealing with a lot of different sets of issues than you were dealing with before. And I'm assuming every day you're grateful for these opportunities you have.
For sure.
And that right there is a platform for energy and for further health and creativity and so on. It like feeds itself.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, Brian, congratulations on everything. I've been following, of course, all of your successes, and I've been really excited to talk to you and catch up. And congratulations again. And good.
Thank you again.
Good luck really saving the world.
Thanks again, and hopefully it's not another 2.5 years before we talk again.
Oh no, I'm sure it won't be. You're gonna save the world first, and then we'll talk in 6 months.
Thanks
Brian. Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com, and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.